Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. President Trump signed an executive order on his first day of office that paused the U.S. refugee admissions program. He said he wanted to see if it aligns with the interest of the United States and if it should be resumed. Trump's order led to the cancellation of flights for thousands of refugees already approved to come into the United States, including children and families fleeing war, violence, and persecution. This comes after some 100,000 refugees were settled in the U.S. last year under this same program. Following the Holocaust, the United States played a significant role as a global leader in refugee resettlement. This was after recognizing the nation's refusal to do more to save Jewish people from Nazi genocide. Today is Holocaust Memorial Day, which takes place on the 27th of January each year. It remembers the 6 million Jews murdered during World War II. It also commemorates the millions of people outside the Jewish faith who were murdered through Nazi persecution and those targeted in more recent genocides. Jessica Dudeau has written the book After the Last Border, Two Families and the Story of Refuge in America. And more recently, she's authored We Were Illegal, Uncovering a Texas Family's Mythmaking and Migration. It's interesting to see how these two books and their ideas fit together in this troubling time. And Jessica Dudeau, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here with you.
Yeah. So I'm going to start off with your more recent book about how we were illegal. Initially, a person might see that title and they might jump to the conclusion that you're talking about a family where they were recently undocumented and they were living in the shadows and then dealing with the sort of the modern or the topics that we have today. But that is not what you're talking about. Tell me how you get to we were illegal when you write about your families. Like multi-generational history in the state of Texas.
Yeah. So when I began the research for this book, I realized after talking with my aunt, I heard a story I'd never heard before. And it's that I'm the descendant of a Bavarian stowaway. So someone who came to Germany on a ship and he, you know, snuck down to the bottom part and came without anyone noticing. And no one in my family ever said, oh, we were illegal immigrants. But that's exactly what we were when we use a lot of the language that's used today. And part of what I wanted to talk about in We Were Illegal are the myths that are passed down in Texas, but also across the nation about what immigration means, how our laws are created, who gets to make the stories that become history, whether it's on a private level or on a public level.
I frequently go to public hearings. The public gets to go to the podium, talk about whether or not certain books should be banned or policies adopted or whatever. And you have a frequent person's like a central casting, and they step up to the mic and they'll tell, my family, we've been in Texas for 150 years, and we did it the right way. We came into America the right way and all those other things. Well, and what rubs me about that is that they assume that somehow because they're multi-generational Texas, that their opinion somehow has more weight than mine. And also they assume that their family got here the right way, because if you go back that far, there was no right way. You just basically showed up.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's not just that. I mean, there actually were official policies in the, 1820s when Mexico took over the border, when it was part of, Texas was part of Mexico after the Civil War, when Mexico won independence from Spain. So there actually were ways to get legal land grants. And I have relatives that go back to in this area since the 1820s. One of my ancestors was a roommate of Stephen F. Austin's, and he owned the land that I live on now in Austin, which I did not realize until I began research for this book. And there were a group of people that created what they called the Tennessee Road, which was the path to evade officials in order to arrive on land in Texas. And that was coming from Tennessee. And so I wanted to really question the idea, Who was legal? What did it mean to be legal? Laws have been changing in this area for generations. And when we pass down stories, yeah, exactly. We always act as if some of us are here legally and other people are not.
Well, and the Mexican government during that time of when Texas was part of Mexico, they had rules in order to for Americans to immigrate here. And there were many, many, including some of those heroes of the Alamo, which did not follow those rules, or they lied about that, or they just snuck across the border. So do they fit into your title?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I look at six different time periods using my family's history across 400 years. Five of the six of them are times when my family members did something that was illegal. And part of it, I look at the Alamo, for example, and the Battle of Goliad and what was happening in the Texas Revolution. And, you know, the story that I received growing up in Texas when I took, you know, Texas history in seventh grade, like so many young Texans, was that the Alamo was a story of freedom. But when I went back to look at the research, I saw the letters that were being put into newspapers that were basically part of PACs, where the leaders in Texas were trying to sell to other Americans that they wanted to come and fight for the Texas Revolution, the idea of freedom, when it was very clear from the very beginning, Stephen F. Austin and the other Texas leaders really wanted the freedom to own slaves. And that's what they were fighting about. They wanted to gain economically by having land in Texas where they could enslave people and make money. And the Mexican government did not want to have slaves. They wanted to abolish slavery. So the Texas Revolution was pretty clearly about slavery. And that was not something that I always understood or that I remembered. And so understanding how the stories have been changed over time and how they've been kind of adjusted with each generation, it really helps us understand a lot of the myths that are being used in our current moment as we talk about immigration.
There has been some conservative pushback on telling that story of Texas history, how Texas gestated and fought for its freedom, that it wasn't about slavery, it was about liberty. But liberty for who? But we do have the documents, we do have the receipts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the things that I say in every interview I do, I am a scholar and a journalist. I have a PhD from the University of Texas. I am an incredibly proud Texan. I'm also a bipartisan critic. This is not something that I come in as someone who is registered with either party. I want to look at the facts. I want to look at the history. I want to actually understand what's happening with immigration today and what happened with immigration in our past. My goal is for us to have better, more factual conversations rather than a lot of the polarized arguments that continue to reign when we discuss these issues today.
Well, that might be your goal, but it's not the goal of the people who control which history books get into the classrooms in Texas or which books get into the libraries in our public school system. It does seem that there is an effort now more than ever to prevent that version of history from being taught.
Yeah, I think that's right. I have a podcast called The Beautiful and Banned about banned books. And part of it came out of my research and trying to understand how stories were controlled, who gets to control the stories, how information is censored, whether it's Juneteenth, when information was censored until troops were able to get down to Texas from the north and tell enslaved people that they'd been freed, or book banning that's happening today. This desire to control information, it has a long history in our state and in our nation, and it's something that's really important for all of us. We need to know the truth, and we need to have good, honest, factual conversations.
We're taking a break here. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We are going to tie this to the refugee program. When we come back from the break, stay with us.
The City of San Antonio Revitalized SA Corridor Leadership Program offers no-cost training for those interested in neighborhood commercial corridor revitalization. Over 9 months, participants will obtain leadership and strategy skills and have an opportunity for grant funding. Applications at sanantonio.gov/EDD/revitalizeSA. This nonprofit message is underwritten by the Economic Development Department.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the second half of the program, we're going to be discussing the book, The Migrant's Jail, the American history of mass incarceration, mass detention of immigrants in America, and how we seem to be locked into a cycle, and we're back in that cycle again. But right now, we're speaking with Jessica Goudeau. She is the author of We Were Illegal, and also the other book she's recently written, The Last Border, Two Families and the Story of Refuge in America. So we have now Donald Trump suspending the refugee resettlement program in the United States. You wrote a book about two families that were in Austin that did benefit from that program. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So after The Last Border was written, really after the Muslim ban, which happened on this day 8 years ago. So not only is this Holocaust Remembrance Day, it was the day that the Trump administration chose to announce that they would be banning people from seven different countries from coming to the United States. I had been friends with former refugees for several years. And so I began working on a book that tells the story of Munah. That's a pseudonym. Both of the women I write about use pseudonyms. Munah had been here in the United States for almost 10 years when I began the process of writing the book, and I wanted to show what refugee resettlement meant for Munah and her family and the group of people from Myanmar that she was a part of here in Austin. But I also wanted to show how the Muslim ban changed the story for Hazna, who is a woman from Syria who arrived just a few months before the Muslim ban and then had the rest of her family be separated because they were no longer allowed to come to the United States. Even though they had done everything that they were supposed to do. And I also told the history of resettlement in the United States to really show how different that first Muslim ban was from what had happened really in our whole history.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, if you've got a question for Jessica Goudeau. What's interesting is that we have a rich and robust history of refugee resettlement in the United States. It has worked for the country. It has worked for these people. It is something that has been an overall benefit. But now It's been demonized, and Donald Trump is saying, well, we're not going to do this anymore, or he's hit pause on it. But I don't know what to make of that, what the conditions would have to be in order to restart the program. Can you talk about how this program has been successful?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the things that I did not really understand until I began research for this book was how incredibly unique this federal program was. I have often said that I wrote After the Last Border as almost a love letter to a federal program that really I'm afraid is ceasing to exist. And it is such an important part of who we are as a country. So it began as a bipartisan effort. The Refugee Act of 1980 was one of the last acts that Jimmy Carter had in his presidency. And he passed it off to Ronald Reagan. And it passed the Senate. When the Refugee Act passed in 1980, it passed with unanimous bipartisan support, which I almost cannot imagine when we have anything about immigration today, that it would be bipartisan and unanimous just feels impossible to me. And so it was something that was a priority both for the Carter and the Reagan administration. There were over 230,000 refugees resettled that first year in 1980. And it was a robust program under every Republican and Democratic president until we got to the changes that happened under the first Trump administration. It has benefited tens of thousands of people. And people who come through the refugee resettlement program are very different from economic migrants or asylum seekers who are crossing the border. This is a program that has very strict vetting policies. They come through a very unique way. And so understanding that these are often being conflated, these two types of immigration visa categories, but they're not the same thing at all. So when they're attacking refugee resettlement, what they're doing is conflating it with economic migrants. And these are very different ways of coming to our country.
So looking at when this went to the Senate in 1980 and if it had gone to the Senate today, we could talk about the major differences in regards to the politicization and the tribalism we have in America. But I also wonder about the loss of the social memory of World War II. You know, in 1980, we still had many of our senators who had fought or participated in World War II, like Bob Dole. He was a war hero in World War II and others. And they recognized, that the war was over, but there was still work to be done in terms. And this was just a continuation of that in order to prevent another outbreak of that type of a war, and just doing good work. And so it's part of the fear that we have today is that we don't have enough people who understand that.
I think that's right. And I think what's so fascinating is it was not something that anyone really questioned. Of course, we were going to help refugees. My grandfather was a World War II veteran, and I have often thought, as I have been working on this over the last 8 years, how much it would grieve him to know that our country has turned our backs on the people that he and so many others fought to save. And I think the Holocaust, especially today on Holocaust Remembrance Day, one of the ideas that came out of that time period is the U.S. led the charge in the late 1940s into the early 1950s to change international law and international alliances is that we would never again allow there to be genocide. And yet we are allowing there to be genocide because we don't want to help people that have proven that they would be persecuted or killed if they are not offered a way to help. And that's what the Refugee Resettlement Program has done. I think there's a collective ignorance about what it means to be a refugee and about who refugees are. And we're really suffering. It's not just refugees who are going to suffer. It's the United States that's also going to suffer when we lose refugee resettlement.
So the families that you wrote about, you tracked for years, and you wrote the book, The Last Border, how are they doing now?
Muna is doing incredibly well, and I think it's such a testament to what refugee resettlement means for people. She lived in a camp in northern Thailand. The average wait, when I wrote my book, when it came out in 2020, the average wait for people living in some of these protracted refugee situations is 26 years. And so for someone like Muna to be able to leave a camp and come to the United States and earn a good living, her family is thriving, her kids are in college, they're just doing incredibly well. So one family really shows what refugee resettlement offers. These are not people who are coming to be a drain on our resources, not at all. They're people who are here to work and have no other option than resettlement. You know, resettlement is only offered to a very few people, and it's a golden ticket, we often call it, in a way for people to really work and provide for their families. For Hasna, however, it's been just a really sad story. I had Hasna and her family over just a few weeks ago. Several of her family members ended up in Canada. They've only seen each other twice now in the last 8 years. And the rest of her kids are scattered. Some are in Jordan. Some ended up in Europe. She sees her grandchildren only on FaceTime. And they're not doing well. One family, one of her sons, still lives in Jordan and has not been able to return to Syria, despite the fact that Syria is now in the early days of freedom. And it has been absolutely heartbreaking for me to see how this incredible family that is so hardworking and so loving and just want to be together, how their lives have been changed for generations based on the policies that happened 8 years ago. And it makes me grieve what's happening currently.
Right. So now there were people who were getting ready to board planes, or they were on planes already. They were heading to the United States. And then Donald Trump signs the executive order saying that we are going to hit pause on the U.S. refugee admissions program. What do you think is going to happen with this program?
Yeah, it's not just that he hit pause. It's that on Friday, they also sent a memo to refugee resettlement agencies with a stop work memo, basically saying even the people who had just arrived in the last 3 months, they're not allowed to help them. The only metaphor that I have is a salt the earth metaphor, where people used to, you know, people who were conquerors used to raise a city and then salt the earth so that they could not plant crops. It seems to me right now like the Trump administration is doing everything possible in order to stop foreign aid and domestic aid to people who have served, who, you know, deserve resettlement. This especially affects people from Afghanistan. There were almost 2,000 people who were coming to the United States who come through the special visa program for people from Afghanistan, and they served U.S. troops in Afghanistan. And so for us to repay the work that they did on behalf of our country, many of them are related to people who served the U.S., it's just a slap in the face. And it is just so heartbreaking for those of us who know what resettlement actually means for deserving people.
So tying this together again with your most recent book, We Were Illegal, talking about your own family's story, uncovering a Texas family's myth-making and migration. How different or apart do you see these books? Because, you know, having done all the work and put these books together, do you see them as connected?
Oh, absolutely. Right now, the arguments that are being used against refugee resettlement are myths. So they're conflating the idea that people who cross the border without documents are the same as people who come through the well-vetted program that equals refugee resettlement. And noting that those myths happen based on historical stories about immigration is exactly why I wrote the book. I feel like the context of We Were Illegal, how those myths were created, how they created our history, really helps us understand why we're changing refugee resettlement based not on the facts of what the program actually is, but on ideas that are not based in truth.
One of the arguments that we hear from the right about why we don't want to excavate our own history and discover the fact that our ancestors were slaveholders or that they were took a part in Jim Crow and these other issues in Texas, is because it makes us feel bad, and we don't want to make our own selves feel bad about that. So how do you rectify the fact that you had demons in your closet?
Oh, absolutely. That's actually one of the things I'm most passionate about talking about as a mother, but also as a teacher, a professor who cares about other generations to come. It is so important to me that we know the truths of our past so that we're not able to repeat them. That's part of why we remember Holocaust Remembrance Day. That's part of why we tell the stories of the terrible things that have happened in our past so that we don't repeat those histories. I don't feel guilty about the terrible things that my ancestors did. I have ancestors who committed genocide. They were enslavers. They participated in a lot of things that I find morally repugnant. And I also had incredible ancestors who changed their minds and changed our family story. And they were not afraid to look at the past, and they were not afraid to call out hard things and hard truths. And I learned from my parents and my grandparents and so many other people that the best way to move forward is to know our history so that we don't repeat it.
Yet here we have Texas, which is being runs on the myth of Texas, or the lies of Texas are upon you. How do we push back against that when it's certainly not a popular view?
I think that it's incredibly important for us to have good conversations with each other today. I think understanding the truth of our history allows us to understand where Texas actually came from. And I actually have a lot more pride in Texas after all of my research, again, because we have a complicated past and there are so many amazing people who did change our story. And I think it also allows us to really understand what's happening. We do need good immigration reform. We actually just need boring bureaucracy. And that's not the kind of discussion that we want to have today. Right now, we're having these polarized, sensationalized arguments, and it's preventing us from actually doing the good work that needs to be done so that we can have good legal immigration and we can keep our agreements with other countries and actually fix the problems that are happening at our border.
But we don't really want to discuss the fact that the Texas that we love and are proud of was built on the backs of the enslaved or formerly enslaved or people who, Tejanos, who were thrown off their land.
Yeah, that's right. And I think allowing us to have those conversations really helps us to have better discussions today. I think, understanding the truth of where we came from, the Texas Republic was the only country in the history of the world to write slavery into their constitution. Like, these were not facts that are difficult to find. They were very proud of it. They were very open about it. These are things that are easy to find. And so I think we do a real disservice to ourselves when we try to hide this history. Nobody is saying we can't be proud to be Texans. We just need to have a clear-eyed vision of what it means to be a Texan.
Jessica Goudeau, her most recent book is We Were Illegal, Uncovering a Texas Family's Myth-Making and Migration. And her previous book is After the Last Border, Two Families and the Story of Refuge in America. She lives in Austin. And Jessica, I look forward to meeting you sometime.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be on the show with you today.
And we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Migrants Jail. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Last week, Congress gave final approval to a bill that requires the detainment of unauthorized immigrants accused of theft and violent crimes. This will be the first legislation that President Donald Trump could sign make law from Congress. This is certainly in line with Trump's plan to crack down on illegal immigration, and there's a lot of history behind the passage of the Lake and Riley Act, which was named after a Georgia nursing student who was murdered last year by a Venezuelan man. Brianna Nofill is the author of the new book, The Migrant's Jail, An American History of Mass Incarceration. And Brianna, welcome to The Source.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, so writing about the history of detainment, incarceration of migrants, it seems like we are ramping up to maybe do this in a bigger way than maybe the country has ever done before. It does seem like we would benefit from knowing how we have done this in the past and some of the failures of the past, because in your book you document that we're kind of locked in a cycle of doing it over and over again and making the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely. The Migrant's Jail is a history of how the U.S. has been locking up migrants and building this absolutely massive deportation infrastructure over the course of a century. The U.S. has been incarcerating migrants en route to deportation for as long as the U.S. has had immigration laws, for as early as the Chinese Exclusion Act at the end of the 19th century. And it's been figuring out, you know, sort of the ways to make this as punitive as possible and to make it as deterring as possible. And it's a really sort of horrific story.
Migrant detention kind of exists in sort of a limbo. During the Biden administration, when he first went into office as president, he signed an executive order saying that they weren't going to use private prisons anymore for U.S. citizens, mm-hmm. but that opened the door for the private prison industry, saying, "Well, then we can lock up non-citizens."
Oh, yeah,
okay. And then mm-hmm. so they went to town, and we saw what basically became this drumbeat for locking up undocumented migrants and that issue. Fact check me on that. That's correct.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is the great loophole. Both Obama and Biden passed these orders, right, saying that the Department of Justice wouldn't use private prisons anymore, which sort of sounds like this tremendous victory. But at the time both of them made these statements, right, passed these orders, the vast majority of the money that private prison companies like GEO Group are making was already coming from migrant incarceration. Migrant incarceration has been the backbone of private prison profits really since the turn of the 21st century. And so it really did not hurt their bottom line that much to lose these DOJ agreements, because that wasn't where most of the money was being made. Most of the money is being made in locking up migrants. And I think that is part of what is so challenging to understand and to research about migrant incarceration is that it is this incredibly patchwork system. You've got private prison companies, you've got local jails, you've got immigration detention centers run by the federal government. And the Immigration Service can move people between all of these facilities. It can essentially make them disappear in this network of sites.
When I was starting out as a reporter, I was working in Laredo, Webb County, mm-hmm. and they had a detention center that was run by the sheriff, and it was for Haitians mainly, and it was out in the middle of the desert, and they were getting all these federal dollars. I mean, you write about very similar things like this in your book. That's why I bring it up. And so mm-hmm. There was always riots happening at this detention center. When we had to call it a detention center because it wasn't a jail, wasn't a prison, mm-hmm. it was something else. And there were riots because such of the terrible conditions for the Haitians and overcrowding, the heat, the terrible food, it was always erupting. But it was bringing in so much money for the county under the sheriff's purview that he basically became like impossible for the county commissioners or the county judge to kind of work with. And he also was able to, because of all the hiring that he was doing by running this detention center, that he was basically able to create his own political machine with all of that. So this kind of illustrates a problem that you document in your book, The Migrants' Jail.
Yeah, this is, I think, exactly what you're describing, is a pattern that we can see for over 100 years. So long before private prison companies are in this game at all, sheriffs in small towns, I look at the Canadian border in the 1890s, they realize that this is a way to make money, particularly in rural communities. If they rent space in their local jails to the federal government in order to aid with deportation, it is essentially a way that they can continue to bring in revenue. So we see communities for, you know, over 100 years who were actually incentivized, right, to participate in deportation work. And I think, as you suggest, right, the incentives for sheriffs are really perverse. Often it means that communities are going to build bigger jails. And you see this time and time again in the history I look at. They build bigger jails because they know that they will be able to rent out some portion of this jail to the Immigration Service. So even though, right, on paper, in court, immigration is this exclusively federal project, what I'm really interested in is the ways that mass deportation has literally never in American history been possible without this cooperation of sheriffs and local law enforcement and access to local jails.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because we're seeing that today, that a lot of pressure on local police chiefs and sheriffs to work with ICE in Donald Trump's mass deportation effort. There's efforts on the state level to pass laws requiring local sheriffs and law enforcement to work with mass deportation, and also executive orders coming from Donald Trump demanding that as well. So why do they need the help of the local Johnny Law?
Yeah, so for most of U.S. history, it's because the Immigration Service simply does not have detention space of its own. The U.S. doesn't really start building its own, you know, sort of immigration-specific facilities until the 1980s, and that is largely a reaction to Haitian refugees and Haitian asylum seekers. But that leaves, you know, about 100 years of restrictive immigration laws of the U.S. wanting to deport people that it deems illegal with no space to put them. So aside from places like Ellis Island and Angel Island, particularly in rural places and places that aren't major ports of entry, the jail is kind of the only place in town that the Immigration Service imagines as feasible here. But I think what's important, right, is a lot of these relationships start as the Immigration Service just renting jail bed space, but they sort of expand, right? They sort of start in this very simple economic relationship, but then law enforcement will sometimes say, you know, is there other work we can do to aid in deportation? Maybe we're worried about illness or crime or welfare, like all of these other sort of stigmas attached to migration. And they start to say, and the Immigration Service writes in its records, right, there's a lot of enthusiasm across the 20th century for local law enforcement to be involved in deportation work. And that's not consistent. You know, some law enforcement offices are really excited about it. Some could care less about doing deportation work. But there's always this lingering question for the Immigration Service and this kind of lingering notion that they could expand their capacity to remove, to deport, if they could leverage the power of local law enforcement. And by the end of the 20th century, as local law enforcement budgets are exploding, that sort of notion that this is where the power is becomes, I think, even sharper.
But it creates this pattern that the local counties may recognize. And these are small population rural counties, and they're recognizing we could actually make a pretty good coin here by doing incarceration. And then you have somebody who comes to the county commissioners and they pitch, hey, we happen to build jails. We can build you a big jail. All you got to do is sell these bonds that are tax-free bonds on the market, and then you could build your jail, and then the government will fill them for you. And then sometimes it works, but more often it doesn't. But you have these county taxpayers left holding the bag on a jail that was built but was never filled, but also an incentive to arrest people in order to fill these jails.
Absolutely. And I think that is something that comes, you know, it becomes really pronounced, particularly the issue of bonds and jail building by the end of the 20th century. But we see it even earlier. In Texas in the 1950s, there's this big sort of controversy when the federal government announces that they're going to start setting up these migrant detention camps, mostly for Mexican workers who are being deported. And there's all this controversy among sheriffs and locals about what it means that they're taking migrants out of the jails. And in one county, they say, you know, we specifically built a bigger jail because the Immigration Service told us they needed this space. And there's this, I think, just very prescient quote where the local newspaper says, you know, now Texas jails, you know, they've got these giant jails and they've got no one to put in these jails but themselves.
Right. And so I got to hit this break here, but to highlight the point that you made, and we are in a cycle, and we will probably get to the point where local counties are going to be building and floating bonds and going into debt to build facilities for mass deportation. And in the end, this will not work out good for them. So here's a warning for you guys across Texas. Don't do that again. But we're going to take another break. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Continue talking about the migrants' jail and American history of mass incarceration right after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about The Migrants' Jail, a new book that talks about the history of mass incarceration, especially with the detention of migrants here in the United States. And Brianna Nofill is the historian and author of that book. So, Brianna, what is Chrome Gate?
Oh, so Chrome Gate is a scandal in the 1990s. About the detention center in my home community of Miami. It's a federally run detention center called Chrome Service Processing Center, and it's in the middle of the Florida Everglades, and it's one of the first federal sites built. It is built in the 1980s when migrants are coming in really large numbers from Cuba and Haiti, and it is a reaction by the Reagan administration to this mass asylum seeking. So Chrome Gate is a scandal, basically, where Congress has heard all of these rumors about how horrific conditions are at Chrome, and they are absolutely horrific. They send a congressional investigation team down to Miami to look into conditions. They're sort of, you know, given this very sunny picture of what's happening in Chrome. And then later they start to hear rumors. They start to hear rumors that since the investigators were coming, the Immigration Service basically took hundreds of migrants out of the facility and dispersed them in jails across Florida. People removed their guns. They hid migrants physically in closets in Chrome. So basically all of these things essentially to deceive this congressional investigation team. And it becomes a really big, I think, symbolic moment of exactly how much autonomy the Immigration Service is operating with, that they feel essentially empowered and comfortable to lie to Congress in this way about what is happening in one of these federal detention sites.
So we should remember Chrome Gate, not let it, you know, be forgotten and then repeat it.
Yeah, and I think one of the patterns that we see in the wake of Chrome Gate that I think is really insidious and we see time and time again in detention history is that whenever a controversy occurs, for example, this is a controversy at a federally run facility, then the Immigration Service says, you know, we agree, this was a problem, and they take the migrants out of that facility and they put them in local jails, right? They spread them out in local jails. Then when there's an issue in a local jail, they say, we agree, that's a problem, we'll move them back to a federal centralized facility. So basically, you know, wherever the controversy is, migrants just move, right? The problem is never solved. It is just this sort of shuffling of people across this range of, you know, incredibly dangerous sites. And that's part of the power of this patchwork network, right, is that it allows this sort of constant movement.
And some of the individuals that were moved from Chrome Gate were sent to other facilities where they were abused with shock shields. Is that right?
Yeah.
So what is that? What's a shock shield?
Yeah, so it's an electrified weapon. These become really popular in the 90s. Police budgets, again, are expanding. They have more money for weapons like this. They're seen as crowd control tools. And they are, so this could be like an electrified baton. It could be an electrified shield. And so one of the records that I found in the archive is this investigation into the use of electrified shields at Manatee County Jail in the Florida Panhandle. And so this was migrants, again, mostly from the Caribbean, who were taken out of Chrome, right, because Chrome was so irrevocably broken. They were sent to Manatee County Jail. And while they were in Manatee County Jail, they were physically attacked with these electrified weapons. And the Immigration Service says it's because they're protesting, right? They won't behave. But I think it's a really important moment because, these electrified weapons were banned in immigration detention facilities. But they're totally legal in Florida jails at this time. They're actually illegal in Texas jails because of a death, but they're legal in Florida jails. So what I think is important about that is that it kind of reminds us that the types of violence that migrants and all incarcerated people are susceptible to in local facilities is different, right? They confronted a different form of, technology and violence in these local facilities than they did in the federal facilities.
So as you lay this out, that this type of enforcement detention becomes a local issue. Local sheriffs, local law enforcement are doing what they'll build these in local areas, typically in out of the way places, away from the scrutiny of big journalist operations. So what can people do in order to provide oversight? Can there be local efforts to keep an eye on these things?
Yeah, I think that we've seen tremendous success in a lot of ways from local activism in recent years. Several states have completely, said that localities are barred from cooperating with ICE for detention space at all. We've seen major wins in California, in New Jersey. At least in New Jersey, this win is being challenged by the government. They're saying that this is not something that you can do. But there has been, I think one of the things that is maybe somewhat empowering about this, right, is that it is a local issue, right? So there is actually something that can be done by putting pressure on your city council, your mayor. And these contracts are so important. Like, even though the vast majority of migrants are held in private detention facilities today, most of those detention facility contracts go through a locality. So in most cases, localities are actually the middleman for these contracts. So ICE doesn't contract directly with a private prison company. In the vast majority of cases, they contract with a county, and then the county contracts with the private prison company. So all of this is kind of designed to make this system feel overwhelming, like you can't understand where it's happening. It's kind of a series of nesting dolls, right? So I think part of, step one is just figuring out what your community's relationship with ICE is, because they are remarkably non-transparent about this. So it is really hard to get accountability, but I think making visible, they're called intergovernmental service agreements. They're this kind of wildly misunderstood type of contract. I think making clear that these intergovernmental service agreements really, really matter in mass deportation and mass detention, I think that's kind of step one.
So this weekend we saw the issue of these deportation flights and how they were being turned away in Colombia and Mexico, the issue of that, and the issue of having migrants who are arrested and we want to deport them. The country wants to deport them, but the country won't accept them. And so then the United States has this problem of what are we going to do with these people? And so we put them in these detention centers and we keep them there for years and years. That's what happened really with the Haitians for such a long time. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be like you just put them in a box and forget about them. But these are people. They have an uncertainty about what their status is, what their condition is, and if they'll ever have any freedom ever again based on their immigration status. And it's a Kafkaesque situation where there are few rules and a lot of wrongdoing. So what are your expectations moving forward?
It's exactly as you described. It's incredibly, it's just deeply dehumanizing. I think one of the things that is really troubling about some of the early signs we've seen is that, it's already incredibly, incredibly hard to access legal aid while in detention. And we started to see, from these early executive orders, like efforts to criminalize legal aid to undocumented people, to migrants, to detained people. I think that's really alarming. I think part of the reason, that detention has always been put in these rural, out-of-the-way places is very much with this notion of restricting legal aid, because we know that legal aid works. We know that your chance of winning your asylum claim, winning your stay of deportation are so much higher if you have access to legal aid. I think another thing that I am keeping an eye on is that the U.S. has also always really been interested in this idea of, could we put detention overseas? This is something that has been very, very popular, prevalent in places like Australia, where detention happens basically on an island off of the coast of Australia, on a separate sovereign nation. The U.S. attempts this in the 90s with Guantanamo Bay. They essentially turned Guantanamo Bay into this massive migrant detention center.
It's like a black ops site, a black site.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's one step further from any chance of due process.
Do you know where they might try to do something like that?
I've seen early indications that El Salvador is interested in accepting deportees from countries other than El Salvador. That alarms me. I think that Guantanamo Bay is always on the table. Biden talked about it, using it as a detention site, so I wouldn't be surprised.
How many could you fit in Guantanamo Bay? My impression is it's not very big.
I think more than you would expect. It's at least in the 90s, they put up, sort of makeshift tents. It is essentially a tent city. So if the standard of living is super low, I think you can.
Right. And that's the other issue is that the cost involved, particularly when we're hearing that the Trump administration wants to get the federal budget under control. Here we are adopting this extremely expensive program with no mm-hmm. end in sight. So, they're going to be looking for ways to try to, get this out of the public's view, save mm-hmm. some money, and try and get it off the radar. Mm-hmm. Brianna Nofill, thank you so much for your book, The Migrant's Jail, An American History of Mass Incarceration. Great talking to you today.
Thank you.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.